The following message was given by Herman Hay on March 14, 1953, in Pasadena, California, USA.
His followers, however, did not all accompany him back to orthodoxy. Some of them remained true. Most of them gave up in the light of in the face of persecution. This is now in the same book, page 267. A man of another caliber arose by the name of Edward Stennett, who wrote about the Sabbath day in 1658. He was kept in prison for a long time, faithful. He was a Sabbath keeper. And I'm going to read a quotation a little bit later about him that I think will amaze us, because the Church of God did go to America. Now, there is a statement also in the second volume by an enemy of God's people, found on page 57 and 58, and it is interesting to notice that this man, by the name of Cowell, John Cowell, said that he was giving up the Sabbath now because he didn't like the teachings of some of his fellows. For, it says, that one Thomas Tillum, Christopher Foley, Edward Skiff, John Fox, etc., etc., who in their principles and in their practices were doing so many horrid and abominable things, corrupted the Word of God marvelously, pleading not only for the Sabbath, but for all the rest of the law of God. Apparently, some of God's people at that time still understood that the annual holy days were meant for us. There were a very few who remained faithful. Now they organized local congregations, and by about 1650, they had quite a number of them. So many so, in fact, wasn't too many, it was only about 10 or 12, but in and around London and other areas, that in 1664, they sent a missionary over to America, who landed in Rhode Island. And his name was William Mumford, and he associated himself with the First Day Baptists and converted many of them to the Sabbath truth. Later, other people came over and founded other churches in America. And that is how this church, which was still in existence in England, developed over here in America. And this Mr. Stennett wrote, after 1664, there is in the Seventh-day Baptist Memorial a record of two letters which he wrote in 1668 and 1670 to the remnant in Rhode Island who keep the commandments of God and the testimonies of Jesus Christ. And in the first of them he says, quote, "Here are in England about 9 or 10 churches that keep the Sabbath, besides many scattered disciples, who have been eminently preserved in this tottering day, when many once eminent churches have been shattered in pieces. The Lord alone be exalted, for the Lord has done this, not for our sakes, but for his own name's sake." A letter written to God's people here by a minister in England. Now, all of this goes to show the fact that very little was being done. The gospel wasn't preached like it should have been at all. Most of the people in the face of danger were giving up the truth. The church had a name, the Church of God, but it was really dead. Yet among some of them, it says, there were those who walked in white with Jesus. There were a few who were wholly faithful. Most were not. And Jesus said that he will come upon them when they least expect it, and that they should have repented so that their names wouldn't be blotted out of the book of life. Now, at this time, these people were called by the outsiders Sabbatarians, called by themselves the Churches of Christ and the Churches of God. It was not until 1754 that they were first called by the outsiders Seventh-day Baptists, because they baptized and kept the Sabbath. But it was later than that date even that they finally adopted that name in England, 1754. And most of them have since withered away, and there's almost nothing left of Seventh-day Baptists in England. In America, however, the people remained a little more faithful, still very weak. Dozens of churches were founded on the eastern seaboard and even west of the Allegheny Appalachian Mountains. In 1802, many of these local churches said, "Let's get together. Let's form a general conference, not God's government, but a general conference." Let us vote for leaders. Let us do this and do that in order to carry out the gospel. And so they adopted the name Seventh-day Baptists in a general conference. And that's how our Seventh-day Baptists originated today, from Church of God people who cut themselves off from the truth. Now, they didn't all cut themselves off from the truth, because it was the work of the churches as a whole which was organized. But they did not control in a hierarchy form, so many of those people associating with them yet remain faithful. Many associating with Seventh-day Baptist churches remain faithful. But I have a quotation. I'm not going to read it to you all, but it is from Randolph's History of the Seventh-day Baptist, page 213, that not all of those churches were members of this conference. He mentioned seven or eight which did not become members, but which stayed outside of the truth. Outside of the Baptist General, Seventh-day Baptist General Conference. And these people held the truth. It was about this time that the Baptists were adopting the Trinitarian viewpoint. And I have in this book, by Duggar and Dodd, for History of the Church of God, one statement. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it mentions, let me see if I can turn to it, I think it's page 277, that among some of those were people who still understood that man was mortal, people who did not believe in the Trinity, people who did understand the kingdom of God to a great extent. But among Seventh-day Baptists now, among these people, there developed the idea that man had an immortal soul, that God was a Trinity, and that we have to organize ourselves in general conferences, and that's how the present Seventh-day Baptist doctrine has gone wrong on those points, although they understand much more truth than most other denominations. Next, after these churches remained faithful for some time, there is proof that some of them kept the annual holy days. They were accused of it. I don't think this time is already fleeting by. I don't want to take too much more time, but they were accused by some Baptists, Seventh-day Baptists, of keeping the annual holy days. Some churches did. But God's truth was almost nil as far as any organized group carrying out his gospel. This truly was the Church of God, but it was dead. It had a name that it was alive, and that's all. The next terrible thing that befell this church was the Adventist movement, started by Sunday keepers, a Mr. William Miller, who, by the way, was more willing to repent than most Adventists are today. This William Miller, a Sunday keeper, understood much of the truth about prophecy and Christ's second return, and he preached about it. He preached that Christ would come in 1843. That failed, so he said it was October 22nd, 1844. Christ didn't come. He gave up the date, but some of his friends didn't. Now, just before this time, a Seventh-day Baptist woman introduced into a first-day Adventist church the doctrine of the Sabbath. And it was after 1844 that the whole Adventist church, First-day Adventists, were introduced to the teaching about the Sabbath. I have a book, lest any person doubt it, published by the Adventists themselves. This isn't bogus. I sent for it and paid good money for it. Shows where the teaching of the Sabbath got started, and it came from the Baptists, the Seventh-day Baptists, in the First-day Adventist movement. But these Adventists, once they understood the Sabbath, they broke themselves off from other Adventists who kept on Sunday. And you know, you've seen First-day Adventist churches and not all Seventh-day Adventist churches. But they didn't join with the Seventh-day Baptists. Instead, they came into contact with the remains of God's churches, the churches of God. And so you do hear of James White and Mrs. E.G. White and many others at that time. And they had a song book out, dedicated to the churches of God scattered abroad. No, not to the Seventh-day Adventist churches, but to the churches of God scattered abroad. They claimed to be ministers of the churches of God, but they were introducing heresy and error. They would not give up this date, October 22nd, 1844. Now, it might be interesting. I don't think this is too important. Let me see if I can find that. But the Adventists who prayed and studied to know the true nature of the event which they were certain had taken place, notice it, they didn't ask God, like William Miller, did I make a mistake in calculation? No, they wouldn't give that up. They said, it's certain that something happened on that day, therefore, we're going to have to find out another explanation than the one that Jesus is going to return to this earth. And so they invented the idea that Jesus entered the Holy of Holies in heaven and was going to purify God's very unholy and dirty sanctuary. Now, it might interest you to know that this date, October 22nd, 1844, was supposedly the Day of Atonement in that year, because Jesus, you see, was to enter into the Holy of Holies. Now, the Day of Atonement can never fall on October 22nd. Therefore, nothing ever like that ever did happen. That would put the Feast of Tabernacles from October 27th to November 3rd. That would put the Passover almost at the beginning of May. Check in that encyclopedia by the Jews over there. Kenneth can tell you the same thing. The Day of Atonement can never occur as late as the 22nd of October. That day is wrong from the very beginning, much less whatever supposedly took place on it. The Adventists just imagined that date and that's all. If they checked with a calendar, they'd know better. But they weren't willing to change that, they weren't willing to change the date, and then they invented doctrines that were wrong. They began to talk about the first angel's message, and then the second, and then the third angel's message. They did understand about the kingdom of God, but now they were beginning to wonder, since the judgment may have gone on already, perhaps there wasn't a kingdom to be set up after all. And they said, well, perhaps the earth is going to be desolate, and so they picked out some scriptures in the Bible that described a desolate condition, and they applied it to the millennium. They published their magazine, which was called the Remnant of It. I'm not sure if that was it or not. No, they had another one. I forget the title of it originally. It ended up anyway as the present Sabbath Review and Herald, and also they had another one, maybe the Signs of the Times. But these were still God's churches at this time, even though this woman was beginning to have visions. And finally, many of these local churches got together and said, between September 28th and October 1st in 1860, let us get together and organize a general conference so that we can begin to publish this gospel that they were going to preach, which wasn't the gospel of the kingdom anymore. And they had a conference. Now, I've taken a copy from another Adventist book and written it here by, it's called The Great Second Adventist Movement by Lawborough, page 250, and it shows. I don't want that page, I want another one here on page 350. And the general gathering of representatives of our people from Michigan and several other states held in Battle Creek from September 28th to October 1st, there was a candid consideration of the subject, a full and free discussion of legal organization for the purpose of holding the office and other church property. They were going to have publishing equipment now. Now, this was discussed in various issues of the review. And it goes on, page 351, this conference also took into consideration the subject of a name by which our people should be called. This again called forth a diversity of opinion, some pleading for the name, and some one name, some for another. The, quote, Church of God, unquote, being proposed, it was objected to, on the ground it gave none of the distinctive features of our faith, while the name Seventh-day Adventist would not only set forth our faith in the near coming of Christ, but would also show that we observe the seventh-day Sabbath. So unanimous, it wasn't holy, but so unanimous was the assembly in favor of the latter name that when put to a vote, only one man voted against it, and he soon afterward withdrew his objection. And that is how the Seventh-day Adventists organized themselves apart from God. Calling themselves the Seventh-day Adventists, preaching another kind of gospel, having a prophetess in their midst, and they began to organize local congregations to accept others by vote. And I might mention here, is how they associate themselves with one another. If I can find the... In the spring of 1861, a committee of nine ministers was selected to study the Bible on the subject of church order and offices. And they finally decided, here's the kind of covenant we're going to have to organize ourselves. Now listen. Is this what you find when the apostles gave the others, Paul and the rest, the right hand of fellowship, that God had put him in the church, and they were accepting him as a brother? Here's what they say. We, the undersigned, hereby associate ourselves. Oh, isn't that nice? We're going to get together. Now, we're going to associate ourselves together as a church. We're associating ourselves together as a church. Taking the name of God? No. Seventh-day Adventist. Covenanting to do this and that. That's how that organization began. In 1861, there appeared in their own magazines articles that the word Seventh-day Adventist should not be applied to God's people, but it should be the Church of God. And many did not go along with that movement, but remained faithful. These people organized themselves apart from God's truth of merely Seventh-day Adventists of today. But God's ministers, a few of them were left, called themselves the Church of God, had their headquarters first in one city. It was originally in Salem, then it had moved to another place, and finally down to Stanbury, Missouri. They organized various local congregations. They did preach some truth. They had quite a lot of error. Some of them even had a certain understanding of the holy days, and I hope some of you will remember that Wayne Cole, where is he? Yes. Your father mentioned that in the last century, I don't know the man, the man's name, you may, but if I'm not mistaken, Wayne can correct this later, his father or his mother would not marry his father until Wayne's father understood the truth about Israel, that the United States and Britain was Israel. In the last century, they had that much truth even then. Now, not all of them did, but I believe it was one of Wayne Cole's, one of the uncles or granduncles of Wayne Cole's mother, did preach that truth and understood who Israel was today. Scandinavian peoples, England, and the United States. God's people haven't been blind all these centuries. There's been more truth than we imagine. But so little, like John wrote here, strengthen them which is about ready to die. It was about ready to die. And so a lot of these local churches themselves gradually organized. And they had their state conferences. They called themselves the Church of God, but as far as carrying the gospel out, they didn't have God's government. Yet in the local congregations, they still served God. They had, as a whole, elders and pastors. Over the local congregations, apparently, they still had a certain amount of God's government, but as far as gathering taking the gospel to the world, they didn't. And it couldn't in that condition. And so in 1933, these churches, and this is still the age of Sardis, it's all but dead, began to organize themselves in the 70 and in the 7 and the 12 and a lot of other things. I think that year is correct. And as it happened, of course, they pulled out names out of the hat, and one of the 70, according to their choice, of elders was Elder Herbert Armstrong of Oregon. He wasn't there and didn't know anything about it. But they just do things like that because they want to organize themselves and have a big to-do about having 70 and 7 and 12, and that has nothing to do with God's government. It was just certain numbers chosen at that time to minister to the local church in Jerusalem. And because, I think Mr. Armstrong has explained this, I don't want to go into any more detail. It was about this same time that Mr. Armstrong wrote concerning certain truths to the leader of this church. Not necessarily the leader in the sense of a dictator, wholly, but the man who was looked up to and who did most of the guiding because he manipulated the pocketbooks. And he asked him if he would admit that this is not the truth. I think the subject was whether Jesus was arrested on Saturday. And I think it was about the understanding of Matthew 28:1, if I'm not mistaken. And that man said, Mr. Armstrong has mentioned it, that I believe you are right. You have found new truth, but he said, you've got to close your eyes. We can't look for any more truth. If we had a saving message then, well, we should have got one. Now we don't want any more truth. The point is, they didn't have a saving message really before, if you ever can ever apply such a term to the gospel. A lot of them were preaching the third angel's message and not the kingdom of God. Well, that's what was going on. They still do today. They did know almost nothing about the kingdom. But the time had come, and Mr. Armstrong had to decide, and I'm not going to show how he was associated with them, and how he learned many truths and met with them. Now, I think that's, as far as this is concerned, that's been discussed, but he was among them, among the Church of God. He had been baptized. He had received God's Spirit, and God had opened his mind. God had given him training, just like God had given Constantine, like he had given Waldo training for the purpose of carrying out this gospel. And so it was that in 1933, Mr. and Mrs. Armstrong and several other people and other ministers, I believe, also wouldn't go along with that reorganization and decided to rely on God. And I believe Mr. Armstrong mentioned about having several other ministers as helps, but they didn't pan out. They just weren't of the caliber that they should have been. Too bad. But many people did not follow along and still stayed with them. Now, how different is the Church of God today than that pitifully weak condition from the days of after the death of Waldo, all through the history of the Church of God in England, in the United States, to the time of the Seventh-day Baptists and then the Adventists, which organized themselves apart from God, even to our time? Hasn't the great thing taken place? They were just as dead as could be. They had the appearance of being alive, and only a few remained faithful. Now, notice, this begins with verse 7 of the third chapter. Under the angel of the church at Philadelphia, these things says the Holy One, the true, that has the key of David, who opens and none shall shut, and who shuts and none shall open, showing God's Christ's authority, that he himself has the key of David, that is, the key, the authority, the responsibility of having the throne of David, yes, and that can open up to us the opportunity to sit on that very throne, which is David's throne. In other words, inheritance into the kingdom. That's as far as what Christ can do for us as far as eternal salvation. Going on, Jesus said, I know your works. Lo, I have set before you a door opened, which none can shut, that thou hast a little power, and didst keep my word, and didst not deny my name. Consider that. A church with little power, before whom Jesus Christ said, I will set an open door which no man can shut. Now, Jesus doesn't deal in redundancies. He has already mentioned he's the one who opens and shuts the doors, as far as letting us into the kingdom and opening these ways and sitting on his throne. But now he's talking about our works. What's the work of the church? To get out the gospel. Didn't Paul say many times that God has opened before me? Let me see if I can turn to that right now. This is 2 Corinthians, I believe. 2 Corinthians 2, 12 and 13. The very time after the first 19-year cycle when Paul went to Europe, here's what he's describing. Furthermore, when I came to Troas to preach Christ's gospel, and the door was opened unto me of the Lord, I had no rest in my spirit, but I found not Titus, because I found not Titus my brother, but taking with my leave of them, I went from thence into Macedonia. And he describes the door being opened as a way for the preparation of the gospel. And Jesus says he's going to set before this church a door open, and no man can shut it. This is a church that has little strength, but one that has kept his word and has not denied his name. Now, there's something else mentioned here. Lo, and the King James says, I will give. I think that's a very serious error. The real translation should be, I am giving. Now, the King James says, I will make, I believe, in fact. Behold, I will make them the synagogue of Satan, which say they're Jews and are not, but do lie, and so forth. Now, I think we remember that in the Church of Pergamos, the type was, instead of being the synagogue of Jews in the original city, It was this great false church, the Catholic Church, that rose up and was so predominant during the days of the Paulicians in Asia Minor. So today, God says that there is this, and it's not just the Catholic, it's the Protestant and all the rest. These churches who claim they're the churches of Jesus Christ and are not. Now, it does not originally say, and John did not write it, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, but the original Greek is this, Lo, I am giving of the synagogue of Satan, of them that say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. God is doing that now. Well, what's he doing? What does it mean? That he is giving us people out of these false churches, opening their minds to see the truth. He's giving those to us at this time. We are a church with little strength. Have you ever stopped to think of this? Even Stanbury, the Church of God, has between 5 and 6 times as many members as we do. That is, taking the least calculation among them, and some of them rounded up much more than that. The Adventists have over 500,000 now, or is it, I think, about 500,000. Thank you very much. The Churches of God, even in a sense, claim to have over 40,000 by one estimate, which means, I think, those who get the magazine and so on, that's the way they work it. Hundreds of thousands were put to death in the Middle Ages. How many members do we have? How many people are really serving God at this time? Knowing that there are several who have never been baptized by us, who have come to see the truth, and considering all those who have been baptized, we have only about 1,000 to 1,200 who are really faithful, even in the least, and less than 1,000 in the most. The Church of God today has fewer individuals than in any great period of development in the Church at any previous time. The smallest that it has ever been. And yet, with that weakness, the fact that we have remained faithful and have not denied his name, God has set before us an open door which no man can shut. Now, not only is God giving us of the synagogue of Satan today, but it says now, I will make the future, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan to come down and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you. This is not speaking of today. This is speaking when these people to whom we are going to preach, all of us as a church, when they're going to come before our feet when the kingdom is established and worship before us and acknowledge that we were God's people. And no one's worthy of worship except God, and we're going to be God's sons and born of him at that time. So it shows you, see, Mr. Armstrong has mentioned this time and time again, the great harvest that is going to take place is not now, but after the kingdom is set up. When people hear this message, they're going to know that Jesus did love us. But he even now is giving, I am giving, of these other churches to you to this at this very day. So Jesus does love us, after all. And if this isn't the church, this age, the Church of Philadelphia, where has it ever been? That's where I made my mistake, when I thought, I just took for granted. I took for granted that the Adventist movement was the Church of Philadelphia. That's what the Adventists interpreted. I took that for granted. They never carried out any gospel. They were even Sunday keepers at that time as such. This is the time that Jesus has set his love on a few individuals. But let's remember, even though the work of the church is typified by the Church of Philadelphia, all of these churches are extant to this day. The Church of Eugene was exactly like what church? Sardis. Almost as dead as a bone. I'm glad we got some life up there now through the tremendous assistance of Raymond Cole and the prayers of others. All of these churches are found at any one time. But the predominant thing is the Church of Philadelphia today. We are this church. When I thought of this, I'll tell you, I've been having a problem. I see the work, I saw, let's put it in the past, I saw the work that God was doing through Mr. Armstrong, how it had gone to the earth, how God has opened these various ways, and to think he was going to spew it out of his mouth, I could not understand. I just couldn't understand that until all of these things clicked. This is not that church at Laodicea which is yet to come. This is the church that Jesus said, because you did keep the word of my patience, I will also keep you from the hour of tribulation, which is going to come upon all the world, to try them that dwell upon the earth. And I think all of us have taken a little more courage, especially those to whom I mentioned this before. When we try our best, I'm going to take Rod Meredith, he's not here, as an example. You can tell him I talk behind his back, I don't care. He didn't hear about this until I mentioned it to him, and Rod didn't understand it right away, just like I didn't believe it for a long while. And I said this, Rod, what is wrong with the church at Laodicea? Well, he said they're self-satisfied. Well, I said, Rod, are you self-satisfied? Well, he says, no. I said, I know all things are wrong with me. You know, that's exactly what we have overlooked. We realize how little we are. We realize all the mistakes we make. I realize all the mistakes I make. But the point is, we are not self-satisfied. We have recognized that we are small and not great. But God has added all the difference. He is carrying this gospel. Now that doesn't mean because we've set an open door that we can just stand back here and think God's going to pull us through. We've got a work to do, and we've got to be careful that we don't slam this door ourselves, or not. We can't actually, but the point is, we can cause that our part in this work can fail if we're not careful. And that means that we're just actually not making use of the door. And the Catholic Church controls that Radio Luxembourg whether we like it or not. It's a French Catholic company. We can be mighty thankful that the devil is even letting us use one of his own instruments, huh? Well, they know. No, the devil's got to do some things. He certainly wouldn't have allowed it if God hadn't made it possible. But those men don't know why they built that station over there. But it means this, that we have yet this gospel to take to all the world. And those of us who at this time are having our part in carrying this gospel to the world, that means all of us here, if we remain faithful and hold fast, are to be accounted worthy to escape the tribulation that is going to come on all the earth. That puts this church as though it were living to the very time of Christ. Now, you will remember I said the Church of Sardis contained this one statement, which is wrong in almost every other statement in the King James Version here. It says, I will come on you. Well, the fact is that the Adventists and the Seventh-day Baptists and the Churches of God are still in existence today. And among some of them are possibly people who were converted. I really don't. Now, here's the way. There, I've associated with a few Seventh-day Baptists. They don't understand much truth. They do understand the book of Revelation, by the way, just like we do. Their interpretation, I was amazed, that the book of Revelation is exactly what our understanding is. But they have other things wrong. They understand a portion of the gospel, even. They're almost dead. They're not. God isn't working through them anymore, but he may have a few individuals who have never come to see all of these things. There, God will come on them at that time. The same as the churches of God, of which there are a few, who may yet be faithful. And even among the Seventh-day Adventists, there are people, and I was brought to see many of these things by Seventh-day Adventists who did not accept the false prophecies of Mr. D.G. White. There are Adventists who associate with them and who don't believe all their errors. But you see, if those people are going to stick with those churches, they're going to have to go through that. But God has promised that we will not have to if we faithfully carry out our part. But what's going to happen? Doesn't Jesus say, write to the church of the Laodiceans? Then that's to come. This is a terrible condition described. I know your works. You're neither hot nor cold, and it shouldn't be cold. I think that's all right, though, cold or hot here. That is not feeling their need of God's Spirit and their poverty of natural things and calling upon Him for help. Neither are they hot or zealous, boiling over for God's service as they should be. This church is a church self-satisfied. A church that Jesus said, I'm going to spew out of my mouth, and because I love my sons, I'm going to chastise them. And you better buy of me gold tried in the fire, so you can see truth and have righteousness. Now, what's going to happen? I think that in the sermon Sabbath, Marion McNair mentioned a very important point. When Jesus comes, five virgins are worthy and five are not. Is that not typical that in the years ahead of us, nearly at the close of this age, when a gospel is about out, when the numbers in God's church, and I was figuring out this, if they continue normally, and there's no indication they will, within about 19 years, there is the possibility that this church may number over 20,000 scattered. And the way God works it, it seems that it doesn't just grow in a straight angle, but it's not like an arithmetic progression, but rather that it's a geometric progression, that the longer it goes, the greater it becomes by comparison. And it may run up into several tens of thousands, for all we know, by the end. But at the rate we are growing now, if we have another 19 years, we will have at least 20,000 people. That's including only America, and what about the rest of the world? Now, the world is going to have it reasonably easy. That's what's going to happen. It looks not too bad. There are troubles everywhere, yes. But as a whole, the world is resting on its laurels, hoping that the worst won't come, shoving it in the future, afraid to face it. And many of these people aren't going to be converted to this work because of tribulation. Many of them are gradually going to accept it, and by the way, many of our children are going to be growing up then. In fact, there's, what will I be in my 40s? Well, my hair is already this far back. Some of us will no longer be alive here. But that doesn't matter. Jesus is going to resurrect us. The grave cannot prevail against His church. But remember, many of the younger children have just grown up into this. Many outsiders will never have gone through the struggle. We're all learning things, and we've struggled to learn these things. We have had to knock before God opens it up. The world is just receding now from us. And what's going to happen, and it's the most serious danger. Marion brought it out, Marion McNair before, Raymond McNair this morning. We've got to watch. Because prophecy shows that at the close of this period, only those few who have really been used all this time in carrying out the gospel are going to remain faithful and escape. But the vast majority are going to take it lightly. They are going to look on the church as a social club. And they are going to go through the tribulation. And that is typified by this church at Laodicea, where Jesus shows that He is going to. Let me read a little bit more about that, if I can here. They think they're rich in that sense. They will. They've learned, they just notice these things, that take them for granted, they read about it. They haven't had to learn it like we have. Might be a warning to some of the newer members here in the students. Most of the students, inside 2 years of being here at college, will know as much as it has taken us 6 years to learn. It has taken us 6 years to learn what it has taken Mr. Armstrong 30. Now, that's a fact. And there's no reason, I mentioned this in the Bible class, that, in other words, if time would go on, let's just put it that way, but the time won't go on, but the younger you are, you're going to know more than all the rest who are older, even those who are students now. Because more knowledge is being revealed. God is guiding his church in the truth. So let's not let the fact that you are getting knowledge because somebody else has labored make you sag down and just take it for granted. That's only our part. You have all got your part to do, too. And I'm very glad to see that so many of our older people, especially, are beginning to train themselves. And now I'm going to say this for all of us. Dr. Lippman is going to take a speaking course. I've been hoping that for a long time. I think he can speak even now, but let's say we'll hope he speaks better. Someday, some of those people who are older here, they're not going to be evangelists, but people do need to have responsibilities, and this college can't be used wholly for training local ministers. We do need people who have had the wisdom of years to guide and to direct people who are coming to the truth, and the coach that can go and, who can go and visit them. But we've got to be careful, and all of us can fall into this category. Some of us may be in there right now because the church of Laodicea is extant today. All the rest are, as far as either local congregations or individuals. But this is the age when, as a whole, we are typified by the Church of Philadelphia. So let's look ahead and realize what Jesus said is going to happen. Because of the abounding of iniquity, the love of many is going to wax cold. Yes, instead of being hot, you're going to get cool, lukewarm, not icy cold and feeling in need of God, but lukewarm. That's what we've got to guard against. But let's not end on a sour note. Let us instead realize what we are by prophecy. Let us realize our duty. Let us therefore take courage, like Paul said. All of these, if we see these mistakes, we're to read, whoever has an ear, what Jesus says through the Spirit to all of the churches. Let's take all of the admonition, but realize this privilege and duty that is placed upon us as God's church today in carrying out this gospel work. In other words, the Church of Philadelphia then will last, perhaps we don't know, until the second coming of Christ in that sense. Well, as far as a separate development of the church, about another 20 years and that'll be all. But even toward the end of that period, it may not be that long, we don't know. The Church of Laodicea, and it's certainly going to set in before it's finally completed, is going to be predominant, and let us not be found in that group. Let's be sure to take courage and to encourage one another constantly. And that's why these local assemblies are here. And if we use them rightly, we can learn and understand and grow and take heart, pray as we ought to, be diligent, be constant, and not turn back. As one of the daughters-in-law, those Naomi did, because then Jesus is going to turn his back on us.
This message is provided by the Bible Study website at address www.biblestudy.org and Barnabas Ministries. Bible Study. You have questions, the Bible has answers. Message introduction and closing by Dave Williams, digitizing and editing by Alan Ruth, and post-production by Mike Summers.